Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The January LA fires got us thinking about fire risk in our region. Last summer and fall, red flag warnings were issued on multiple occasions. Those warnings signal an increased risk of fire danger due to warm temperatures, very low humidity, and stronger winds. Joining us to talk about fire risk in the region and how towns and the counties are preparing and coordinating are John Burke, Fire Department Chief and Emergency Management Director of the Town of Sandwich, and he's also President of the Cape and Islands Fire Chiefs Association. Welcome, Chief.
Thank you.
Mike McGuire is director of the Barnstable County Cooperative Extension Service, oversees the county wildfire plan.
I do. Thanks, Mindy.
And Joshua Nigro is the District 1 Forest Fire Warden for Barnstable, Dukes, and Nantucket counties. He's also part of the Department of Conservation and Recreation Forest Fire Control. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
I'm not sure who should start with this question, but have there been wildfires in this region historically? And if so, you know, what were they? What were the sizes? And who wants to start with that?
I can start off, and then I'll hand off to Josh.
Sure.
So wildfire history in the Cape goes back, you know, hundreds of years. But more recently, in the last 100 years, we've seen significant fires in the Upper Cape, especially in 1940s, 1950s. There was a significant fire in 1960 that did impact the town of Sandwich. It came through the base, mm-hmm. right over Route 6,
wow.
Where Heritage Museum and Gardens is now, and it actually ended at the canal.
That's a big fire.
So that was a big fire. So we've had some significant fires, again, in the 60s and 70s, and Josh can speak to some of the work that DCR has done on the history.
So the fire history on Cape Cod, like Chief said, you know, started with the Native Americans and the Wampanoag tribes, with them burning as they go and protecting their lands for hunting and for, you know, this their usual thing. And part of the history, we got AmeriCorps Cape Cod to really finalize the history, because we had the Cape Cod Community Wildfire Protection Plan, but part of that plan that was missing was the fire history. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that we did is had AmeriCorps placement actually go to a lot of the different fire departments, go through all the records, mm-hmm. and then actually go through the town reports to be able to kind of glean some of that information out, so that we do have a more accurate picture of what the fires were, so that we can really basically have a good place to start our prevention efforts and where do we need to focus on.
Right. So do we know how these fires started, the historic fires?
Some were lightning strikes.
Oh, okay.
And then when you look at the historical, some were unattended campfires.
Mm-hmm.
And Josh, you saw.
Yeah, and a lot in the early years were actually trains. So
trains?
Because we had a lot of trains on Cape Cod,
oh.
a lot of our fires were along, you know, the railroad right-of-ways. Mm-hmm. And then also cranberry farmers and some of our agricultural, you know, clearing land and things like that was a big cause. Mm-hmm. And also back in the day, people burning their trash.
Right.
So, you know, we open burn right now from, you know, January till May 1st. But back in the day, you could burn year round. So okay. people would do that.
Just last week, there was an open burn fire in Falmouth that got out of control with a wind shift. So what are the rules or regulations around open burning, and how big of a risk are open burns?
As long as you follow the guidelines, so when you want to burn in your yard, you would go to your local fire department to get your permit. And part of that permit is looking at the rules, which is, you know, 75 feet away from a dwelling, making sure you have hose and tools there with you to be able to put out in case it goes. And also making sure that you're not burning things you're not supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day, people used to like burn leaves and things like that. But it's actually just for brush only.
Brush only. Okay, so you can't burn leaves. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, and definitely never burn poison ivy.
No.
Oh, my goodness.
No,
yeah,
correct.
You're in big trouble. So do people call and ask you that, or do they just burn in their yards?
So what we do in the town of Sandwich is a recorded message. Every morning we update it based on the weather. So we look at humidity conditions, winds, and then we say it's a good day for burning. And we have a list of people that have permits, and it goes back 20 years. And so as long as we give the green light for them to burn that day, they listen to that message, and between the hours of 10 and 4, they're allowed to burn. And if something gets out of control, obviously we're going to be notified. Or if there's a significant amount of smoke, and Josh will touch on the fire towers here in a little bit, but they mm-hmm. see something that's abnormally large in terms of the amount of smoke for somebody's backyard, we'll go out and take a look at it. But as long as and people, especially in the town of Sandwich, are used to it now, they know the rules. They've been doing it for many years, and we just want to make sure that it doesn't get out of control.
Is it the same in all the towns?
So the state regulations are the same
mm-hmm.
In all the towns. And again, the real key key is if we get to that red flag type weather that we experienced in the fall, mm-hmm. we really have to be diligent on making sure people are not burning.
Right.
But pretty much day in and day out, they just rely on the message that we leave for them to be able to call in.
Yeah. Just the Southeast Cape and Islands regions are in a level 2 significant drought. Does that get your attention when you're assessing fire risk? If so, tell us about it.
So what it tells us right now is when we do put the fires out, what we call mop up, and how easy it is to put the fires out. So when we're in a drought condition, the fires burn a little bit deeper. So usually during the springtime, we're able just to put water over the top of the fuels and puts the fire out. But now with a little bit of a drought, the fires burn a little bit deeper. So it takes a little bit more time and effort to make sure the fires are out.
Mm-hmm. Mike, describe how the county and town fire chief prepare for wildfires. And is there a specific plan in place, which we know there is? Tell us about
that.
Yeah.
So the county has many different mechanisms to address wildfire in the region. And our primary tool has been for the past 25 years having the AmeriCorps Cape Cod program available to provide labor to each of the towns. So there's many different mechanisms you can use to reduce the risk to any given property. And there are control burns that you could do. You could do a mechanical removal. You could put in fire breaks and certainly do outreach and education with the FireWise program. So we've utilized AmeriCorps members in many different ways. And the AmeriCorps Cape Cod program is a federal program that the county has a one-to-one match with. So we bring those folks in. And then the other side of what we're doing for the county is providing funding in cohesion with the state and the feds to write community wildfire protection plans. And in the Northeast, Barnstable County had the first regional community wildfire prevention plan. So it was an effort for all 15 towns to work together, kind of like we do with our groundwater, mm-hmm. say, hey, we got a risk that extends beyond our boundaries. So we'll work regionally to address the potential for wildfire to impact any given town on the Cape.
How often is this risk assessment updated? I mean, how often do you do it?
The plan was written approximately 15 years ago, and it needs to be updated. So right now, Josh's organization has been able to offer up around $40,000. I have a $15,000 proposal out through my department in the county that is being voted on currently by the powers to be. And we're going to utilize that and apply for federal funding that should be around $60,000 to $70,000 we're seeking to update the plan completely. Mm-hmm. And as Chief Burke and I were talking earlier, this plan, the county's wildfire plan, is integral to the town's five-year hazard mitigation plan. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
And that's a FEMA-funded analysis, basically, that the towns will undertake. Wildfire is part of that risk analysis, mm-hmm. as part of the hazard mitigation plan. So the town of Sandwich just completed theirs, and ours was actually elevated from its previous ranking in 2016 when we did some of the initial work. So, again, you have the fuels that are there. You look at the urban interface, which is building into the wooded areas, you know, the properties that abut the woods, and that the hazard mitigation plan, you know, flooding has been a big thing, but we did have to elevate wildfire. And and I think the key to Mike's program is the countywide fire protection plan overlaps with the five-year hazard mitigation plan, which overlaps with each community's comprehensive emergency plan, which is updated every year. So you have this 1 year, 5 year, and then roughly 10 to 12 year on the wildfire protection plan.
And the other thing that's interesting about these wildfire protection plans, it's not your typical plan that towns do and they just take and they put it on a shelf and that's where it stays. This plan is actually being used still today, even after 12 years, with the public outreach, when towns are looking at their high hazard areas and what they need to do. We just used it the other day for an event we did in Sandwich where we were able to print those hazard maps and actually talk to the community about it. So it is a plan that's being used every day.
And it sounds like this is an important thing to update, and you're talking about federal money and AmeriCorps being a federal program. Are you guys worried about funding?
I mean, I've worked for the county for 25 years, and I've stopped worrying about whether or not funding's going to come. You know, I feel like things come in waves, right? Mm-hmm. And right now, there's a lot of discussion about what funding is going to be available and when. My feeling is the people drive need, right? And they're going to communicate with their representatives. And I think that we're looking at something, just like when we deal with coastal processes issues, this extends beyond political boundaries. You know, this bipartisan support for mitigating wildfire risk. And you see this all across the country. So, I mean, things are different at the federal level right now, but that doesn't mean that, there isn't going to be a lot of attention paid to wildfire. So I'm hoping that that won't be the case. The AmeriCorps program, so far so good, and I haven't heard anything on that. But
Are there particular regions or tracts of land on the Cape and Islands that are higher risk of fire?
So I think
all three of you are nodding.
Oh, yeah. Joint Base Cape Cod, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's where a lot of the significant fires had occurred. You have the impact range. So when there's actually a fire in the impact range, a brush fire, we're not allowed to go in, obviously, because of the unexploded ordnance. So we're on the perimeter roads, kind of waiting for the fire to burn to us. So that's kind of a priority area that I have in my region. Mm-hmm. Shawm Kroll, which is where Josh is housed, obviously is another area. But Josh, you want to add a couple other spots?
Yeah, some of the other spots is Hyannis Ponds over by the airport. That's a big tract of undeveloped land with a lot of pitch pine and scrub oak fuels. Mm-hmm. Some of the marshes, like, the West Central Sandy Neck Marsh, then you go up towards Nauset, and then even a lot of the seashore properties that are undeveloped where you don't have a lot of that human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about the islands?
So the islands are another big piece. Nantucket, for us, you know, we look at California, we look at Tom Nevers, mm-hmm. is a big area of concern for me, where you have those houses also close together within all that scrub oak. Mm-hmm. And then on the vineyard, we have the state forest right smack in the middle. That's 7,000 acres with homes and stuff like that. But with Nantucket and the vineyard, we also have community wildfire protection plans for both of those communities. And the towns over there have been very engaged and doing a lot to actually protect themselves, especially with the fire pines, with training and equipment.
Yeah. You mentioned pitch pine, oaks, and brush. So talk about the fire risks associated with this type of vegetation, because we're a little bit different maybe than other parts of the state.
Yes. So the other thing, we look at our pitch pine scrub oak, which is our predominant fuel, which is actually second to the California chaparral as far as flammability. So when you have the dry fuel, you have the weather with the winds, you can really get some really big fire growth from some of those big fires historically.
Mm. We're talking about fire risk in our region this morning. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation or ask a question. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about fire risk in our region and how towns and counties are preparing and coordinating. And with us is John Burke, Fire Department Chief and Emergency Management Director for the Town of Sandwich, President of the Cape and Islands Fire Chiefs Association. Mike McGuire is Director of the Brentsville County Cooperative Extension Service, who oversees the County Wildfire Plan. And Josh Nigro, District 1 Forest Fire Warden for Barnstable, Dukes, and Nantucket Counties. He's also part of the Department of Conservation and Recreation Forest Fire Control. 866-999-4626. Is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. David in Wellfleet has a question. He says, how can the county make it easier on Cape homeowners who want to minimize fire risk to their structures by cutting back trees and vegetation without the constraints of local conservation rules? It's currently really hard to clear property because taking trees requires permitting that usually is accompanied by mitigation. More trees need to be planted elsewhere on the property. Who has thoughts on that? Mike, everybody's looking at you, Mike.
Well, I'll start with one of the big challenges with maintaining private property is, you know, we have to be in compliance with a lot of different considerations. So if you lay within the seashore, they're going to have their own set of rules. We need to consider the Wetlands Protection Act, how far they are away from the buffer. And I sympathize with any homeowner who would really like to do the right thing, but you know, as we were talking in the break, Josh was saying, I'm heading up to Truro after this to go talk with a group of homeowners about what they can do to maintain their property. So there are resources and there are people that I would encourage homeowners to reach out to, starting with their own conservation agents in their town and potentially reaching out to Josh or their fire department in their own town and say, listen, I would like to work collaboratively with you to protect my structure. And we all are on the same page with this, which is, mm-hmm. I hear you. It is frustrating if you have a particular scenario where you would like to remove a tree or several trees from your property. But that doesn't mean it can't be accomplished. We just have to work together to do it. And if there is a situation where it's economically unfeasible for that person, there are many different approaches to it. But I think the best way is to do a collaborative approach and make sure that any group of homeowners that is worried understand that they can get together and work with DCR, work with the town to accomplish a home-based remediation program.
Mm-hmm. And what I would add is people don't know what they don't know. Mm-hmm. So starting with that home assessment, so giving us a call, your local fire department, we'll come out, we'll look at the property, we'll look at some of the different zones that we have. But one of the other big things that we see when we look at the fires in California, some of these other fires from Colorado, it's the home itself and that 5 feet. That is really the big concern. Mm-hmm. If people really concentrate on that, that's where they're going to make the biggest difference. You know, and then we can look at some of those other zones as you go out from the home. But most of the things that people can do to really protect their home is in that 5 feet mm-hmm. to the home itself.
I should say, too, people sometimes think, well, I don't want to call. You know, I don't have a big fire. I don't want to call them and bother. They're busy, busy people, right? But I've never found a firefighter who wasn't more than willing to help you out, even in the most small thing, right?
No, and I we want to be busy. And I spent 9 years of my career in fire prevention, and I welcome those calls. Mm-hmm. And I think just to dovetail on what Mike and Josh have said, looking collaboratively, we have a whole new crop of firefighters that have never seen wildfires. Mm-hmm. And being able to train them, some to even use a chainsaw, and how to properly clear brush. That's stuff that Josh and I have been talking about, that we can maybe address some of these issues working with conservation and homeowners, right, to have parcels of land that we can do some training on with our newer staff.
Oh,
and I think that
yeah.
that is kind of a newer approach that we're looking at, because it does serve the needs of all parties involved.
Wow.
Conservation being able to have a say and to work with us on it, the homeowner getting that clearance that they're looking for, more importantly on the firefighting side, our staff getting exposure.
Yeah,
you do
wow,
not want them to
great
be
great collaboration.
If we can pull it off, that's yeah. what we're looking. I think that's the future of I think addressing all of those needs.
Yeah. Regionally, we've done a good job of setting aside open space, but it also means we have large tracts of undeveloped land that are close to homes. I'm thinking of BB Woods here in Falmouth, and I'm sure there's other examples around the region. What are some of the challenges of fighting a fire that starts in undeveloped areas without road access or fire hydrants?
So I'm going to give Josh a plug here. So the fire tower network, right, it seems antiquated to people. Why do you have a human being up in a tower 60 feet just looking around all day? But first notification is key, and I'll give a quick example in the town of Sandwich. During the drought in the fall, there was at Peters Pond Park, which is adjacent to our fire station, which was closed for the season, the tower spotted smoke, and it ended mm-hmm. up being a trailer fire that would have spread significantly throughout the park if we did not have the early notification. It was tucked away deep enough where you couldn't see it from the roadway. So early notification, and we now have the ability with drones and other unmanned aerial vehicles to go up and get a good idea of where the fire is. And then that leads to the question of access. How do we get to it?
So historically, brush breakers have been kind of our answer, which is driving right through the middle of the woods to get right to the fire. Some of those tactics are changing because they're brush breakers, not tree breakers. Mm-hmm. And as our trees get bigger, access. So we've been kind of a shift in the way of thinking as far as fighting fire. So we've been doing a lot of training with our Cape fire departments in doing like hand line, progressive hose lays, and even maybe just kind of building that box and not really have to go after it and kind of do more of an indirect approach, you know, looking at our roads around the fire and letting it kind of burn to us, or even putting fire on the ground so that it burns to the main fire to actually put the fire out. So it's been a collaborative effort with the towns to rethink how we're putting fire out. And we've been doing a really good job with the towns with getting themselves trained in some of the national standards for wildland fire, which we call the 130-190. And in most states, that's part of the Fire 1 and 2 curriculum. Massachusetts not, but our fire departments are seeing the value of that and getting their guys trained.
Yeah.
Wow. I was going to say, too, I think this is a great opportunity to discuss. It's our role as fire professionals to educate the public, and being on a show like we are today, I would love to take the opportunity to talk about how important it is for our community to understand why we want to have certain tactics. We all love pristine woods. We all enjoy the nature that we have around us, but we need the community to be able to work with us and understand, hey, if we punch in a fire road, or if we need to do a controlled burn to reduce fuel load, or if you need to see a group of folks in mowing and masticating understory, there's a reason we're doing it. We're not trying to disrupt the beauty of the land. We're trying to create a situation where we're managing the land properly so that we don't have giant wildfires burn out of control, jeopardize our communities, jeopardize our firefighters. So there is a balance between the natural landscape that we all love and one of the reasons we all enjoy living here and the practicality of management. So
I think there might be some people who don't know what a control burn is. Tell us what a control burn is.
Well, so, Josh, you're probably the expert.
So the other thing we'd say is terminology.
Yeah.
So not controlled burn, but prescribed fire.
Prescribed fire. Okay, that's a good way to put it, yeah.
You know, we have a lot of parameters that we do. We have to write a big plan. So almost like a doctor, you know, we prescribe what we're going to be the treatment for the land, how we're going to burn it, how hot, what we want to reduce as far as fuel. So that's more, you know, terminology. So
right.
It's
and what about the fire roads? Are some areas, is it easier to get fire roads into some areas than others? Are there some that it's just not possible? Like, there are no fire roads into BB Woods, right?
No, not really in the BB Woods, but yeah. A good example is the town line between Sandwich and Barnstable. There was a large fuel break that was put there in the 60s. It was then cut back again in the 80s, but since then hasn't really had any TLC to it.
Mm-hmm.
And we think, you know, you look at the amount of fires. There hasn't been a lot of fires in, you know, the West Barnstable Conservation Land, so it's not something we think about. But now when you look at those roads and you think about the possibility, so one of the projects we're working with the town of Sandwich, the town of Barnstable, AmeriCorps Cape Cod, is opening that back up so that we do have a safe place to be able to fight a fire again in, you know, West Barnstable Conservation.
Because, you know, if there was a fire, it would be like, why didn't you guys maintain that road, right?
Yeah. And then the other thing you look at compared to when they first put the break in, all the homes that are in that area now.
Right.
You know, before there wasn't that many homes. Now you got these huge neighborhoods adjacent to it. So we want to be able to protect the public.
Yeah. Carol in Falmouth says, what's the risk when our generous supply of poison ivy goes up in smoke and people breathe in some of that smoke?
Well, I think just breathing in smoke in general is obviously not good. But during a brush fire, we make sure our personnel have the proper, face protection, but also trying to project where the fire is going to go, the smoke, and letting people know, right? And giving them the simple tips of make sure your windows are closed. You may have to evacuate. And I just want to highlight that because we saw that in California. Understand where you live.
Mm-hmm.
Understand routes of evacuation. Even on Cape Cod, there are neighborhoods with one way in and one way out. So understanding the risk around you, paying attention if there's a wildfire near you, what your escape routes are, I think are important because we don't want to get stuck in that situation.
And listen to the people who tell you to evacuate.
Correct.
But you don't tell people to evacuate if there's no reason to evacuate.
I do not like to issue that order.
Yeah.
We don't take that order lightly. There's a lot of logistics and moving parts that go into that. But if it gets to that point, and people in California, very interestingly enough, are trained.
Yeah.
There was very little hesitation when you watch what happened out there. But we haven't had an event like that here.
Right. Let's hope we don't.
And
yeah.
Let's hope we don't. But pay attention to those orders.
And the other program, we talk a lot about the FireWise program and doing things around. But the other program that we really need to also concentrate on is the Ready, Set, Go program, which is by the International Fire Chiefs Association, to talk to homeowners about what they can do in case of a wildfire as far as having a to-go kit. Looking around your home, making sure you got your to-go bag that has all those things. So in case you have to evacuate, you know, you have that plan.
Grab and go, right?
Yeah.
One of the issues in the L.A. wildfires was the fires were so large that it was hard to provide water to all the affected areas via the hydrant system. How do fire departments ensure there's sufficient water being supplied to the hydrants?
So obviously knowing your hydrant system in your community, so I can speak for the town of Sandwich, 75% of the community is covered by hydrants, but 25% is not. Mm-hmm. So when you have a fire in that particular area that is without a hydrant, extra resources are automatically brought in, and you have to plan for that. And I think knowing where you can draft water out of ponds, we've done it out of swimming pools, out of people's yards to be able to get water. But it's that pre-plan, really taking a hard look at the area and then what resources can be brought to bear automatically and not waiting.
Mm-hmm. Whit has a question. He says, please comment on the infestation of southern pine beetle in the pitch pine on the vineyard. I believe that one or less of all of the pitch pines on the island are expected to die soon. At Stephen Phillips Preserve in Tisbury, a huge amount of clear cutting of the pitch pine has been done, but there are lots of other dense stands on the island which, when dead, will be very fire prone.
So not clear cutting, but more of a selective cutting. So as far as Phillips Preserve and things like that, we are really trying to look at the best way to get rid of it. So the way we've been dealing with it is cutting it. And at the Phillips Preserve, we've actually been using a curtain burner to actually burn the material so it doesn't actually spread disease. Right now, we actually have a little bit on Washburn Island in Falmouth. So we were just over there last week. We cut about 40 trees, and we'll actually go back in a few weeks and burn all those tree piles in place, and hopefully that will catch it quick.
All right, I have a question about the dead trees. There's some creatures who live in those dead trees. Like, you go to some place like the Wildlife Preserve in Wellfleet Sanctuary, and they don't take out those dead trees because there are creatures. Is that a fire hazard? I mean, some people want to support that wildlife.
It's selective.
Selective
cutting. You know, when you have a lot of trees all close together, you know, that might be an issue, but you could take one or two trees out and leave still a bunch of trees for habitat.
Okay. Aside from conservation land, are there other areas that don't have fire hydrant systems, like National Seashore or the base?
So the base has some hydrants that we can draw from, but there is a lot of open space that does not have water. And Josh can speak about the seashore.
Yeah. And, you know, for us, even when we do prescribed burning, you know, even like yesterday, depending on how we do it, we don't need a lot of water, depending on how we do it. So, you know, yesterday for burning 66 acres, we probably only used a total of 150 gallons, 200 gallons tops.
It's like a whole science to this, right?
It is, by using the wind and the weather and the fuels to kind of guide the fire, and also training our firefighters on how to preserve water and use it for when they really need it.
Mm. So talk about that then with the winds, because, you know, winds shift here. So are you obviously looking at the forecast, especially when you in the morning when you put out your whether you can burn or not, the winds can change. So how do you update people on that, or take that into consideration when you've got a prescribed burn?
So when we look at fatality fires for firefighters and the public, one of the big things is weather and people not being aware of the weather. We look at the fire in Sandwich back in the 30s where the firefighters lost their lives was due to a wind shift. So one of the big things is talking about situational awareness with our firefighters and making sure that we're looking at what the fire is going to do in 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, and making sure we're communicating all those risks and things that are going to change to the firefighters so that they can make better decisions about, you know, this might not be the place to be in 20 minutes. We might need to, you know, back off, find a new place to fight. Mm-hmm. So it's all about communication and risk.
And I'm going to add, so the University of Oklahoma does a lot of weather.
Yeah.
And they have a fire management program right now that they are surveying New England emergency management directors. So the last 3 months we've been working with them, exactly what Josh is saying, situational awareness of weather. You can look at your phone right now and see what direction the wind's potentially going to be in the afternoon. What the University of Oklahoma is looking to do to work with state emergency management folks is assign fire weather people to these incidents. So I have somebody over my shoulder saying at 12 o'clock, you're going to get a significant wind shift. Start preparing your tactics accordingly. And those are the small nuanced details that, you know, if you're not paying attention to, will really drive either a successful conclusion to that incident or have the incident drag on for a significant period of time.
Maybe not to get too technical, but I think the audience might be interested in, with these Josh in particular, I mean, you might want to talk about relative humidity or a backing fire versus a head fire. I don't know if that's
technical. Let's hear about that, yeah.
You know, when we talk about backing fire, what that means is the fire's not going against, it's not going with the wind, it's going against the wind. So again, when we do prescribed fire, we will usually let it do it against the wind, because if we did it with the wind, the fire would just rush across the huge field, versus if, you know, we put it on the downwind side, the fire would just kind of go nice and slow across the area. So same thing if we were on a real fire and we're doing a burnout operation, burning fuels, we kind of do that to better protect it. And we look at relative humidity, which is the amount of moisture in the air. Yes, on Cape Cod, we're surrounded by water, so our relative humidity is usually a little bit higher. But if you have those high winds and if you have the fuel, you know, available, you know, the relative humidity might not make the biggest difference. It's still going to be those fuels and that weather that's going to drive our fire.
It's so interesting how much rural weather plays, right? So what kinds of management of woods or open space can mitigate wildfire risk? I mean, when you're talking, we talk about that road that maybe you have to, it's a lot to maintain, right? I mean, there's a lot of, so what do you do? How do you, you know, what's the...
In terms of prioritizing, like, maintenance, so seasonal workers in Sandwich have been useful in terms of fire road management, working with Josh's folks, identifying and trying to keep those roads clear. And again, it's a training opportunity for our personnel to use chainsaws and to trim back those particular roads. It's identifying and maintaining, and we have plenty that we need to do as fire and EMS personnel in the Cape. But again, collaborating with DCR, with Josh's folks, with conservation, with groups of AmeriCorps to be able to mitigate those spaces is important.
And the other thing I just want to go back to about why homes burn, it's not this gigantic wall of flame that's coming out of the woods. It's those embers that are being generated by the fire.
And the wind takes them?
Yeah. So we, as firefighters, are going to be dealing with that fire, trying to put it out. But you're still going to have those embers. So we really do need help from the public for people to really better protect their homes against that ember attack. Mm-hmm. So doing that home hardening. And again, part of that home assessment process, going around the home, looking at those places where those embers are going to land, and potentially start fires.
All right, let's talk about that home hardening. People are like, oh, what is that? What do I do? So one of the things before we went on the air you were talking about was mulch. And, I mean, everybody uses mulch, right? So how far away do you want that from your house? Talk about some of the things homeowners need to be thinking about.
So I'll mention quickly, and I like mulch, and I use it at my house. But you want a barrier between the foundation and the mulch. So an inch or two at least. Now, if you hire a contractor to do that, don't be afraid to say to them, I want a space between the foundation and the mulch. Because what happens is if it abuts the foundation and the siding of the house and there happens to be a fire, it goes right up the siding. Mm-hmm. I've probably done a dozen of those in my career.
Wow.
So that's one of the a simple thing. And then Josh is going to go into a couple other things.
Yeah. And because of Cape Cod, with our wood siding of our homes, they're very receptive. So definitely, you know, removing mulch, vents on your, you know, your attic places, and even under decks, you know, putting some sort of screen so embers and stuff don't go underneath your deck where all your leaves and stuff are. So and then gutters is another big one where people have a lot of leaves and different things inside their gutters.
So you want to make sure you clean your gutters as well.
Yeah. So most of the things you can do are just basic stuff that you would normally do. You don't have to get a brand new roof or any of those things, but just keep on that maintenance. Make sure that, you know, you have green grass up next to your house, things like that.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about fire risk in the region and how towns and counties are preparing and coordinating with John Burke, Fire Department Chief and Emergency Management Director for the Town of Sandwich, President of the Cape and Islands Fire Chiefs Association, Mike McGuire's Director of the Barnstable County Cooperative Extension Service, who oversees the County Wildlife Plan, and Joshua Nigro, District 1 Forest Fire Warden for Barnstable, Dukes, and Nantucket Counties. He's also part of the Department of Conservation and Recreation Forest Fire Control. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So how do towns coordinate in the event of a wildfire? I know you're all talking about this, but what actually happens? Is it, it's sort of like how you do regular fires when you call in assistance?
So we actually live in a very unique region in terms of mutual aid. The Cape is well known both you know, state, New England, and nationally for a very robust mutual aid system because we're technically an island with the bridges. So the Barnstable County Sheriff's Department maintains the Mutual Aid Center. So anytime, each town will have what we call a run card, and they look at drawing additional resources, and they draw it out over, we call it alarms, so all the way through maybe five alarms depending on the community. So everybody's plans are reviewed, and the Mutual Aid Committee, which is part of the Cape and Islands Fire Chiefs Association, will maintain that and make sure that the appropriate resources are going to be responding. So we have, not only each community has their own wildfire response, but then there's an overlapping regional response, and then there's an overlapping state response.
Wow.
So, and that was activated and heavily utilized off Cape during the fall, especially in Middleton and some of the other fires outside of Boston. We never made it as part of that system. Part of that reasoning is because we are an island. They did not want us coming off the Cape to go to those other fires in case something occurred down here.
Yeah, then it'd be big trouble. You wouldn't be here and hard to get back.
Right.
So when, if ever, might other resources be called upon, you know, like aircraft?
So we've done aircraft. Josh can speak to that a little bit. And again, it depends on the fire spread, the wind direction, and how, again, if you have significant winds, we saw this in California, your aircraft are probably going to be grounded.
Right.
So, you know, weather does play a big factor. Specialized resources are important. Bulldozers are utilized heavily out in California to make those fire breaks. So those are things we'd be leaning on Josh's people and the state to be able to provide if we identified that critical resource.
And just also specialized training for DCR fire control folks and some of the other fire departments that have been doing our training. You know, burnout operations is another thing that we would use. We did it during the 2017 fire at Joint Base Cape Cod, where we had that fire within the impact area, so we couldn't go into it. Mm-hmm. But by utilizing our people that had been trained, we were actually be able to burn around that block and actually put the fire back in there without getting any firefighters hurt. And the other thing about the coordinated effort of response, it's also training. And here on the Cape, we, you know, train as we fight. We're actually doing a large county wildfire drill at the end of March, where we're going to have all the fire departments and towns on Cape Cod actually participating. Mm-hmm. Where we're going to go do some more of these tactics and really get into depth with structure protection and some different.
You should talk about that. That's real. Those training exercises across the board are really important, right? Because then it's like second nature. You know, you've done it.
And I think, so the point of mutual aid, right? So we have a plan. It's great to have a plan on paper. You need to exercise it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Josh is alluding to with the March 26th activity, where all of these things we've put on paper are actually people are going to show up. And it's getting that coordination and understanding the key things that you need to do. You can't do everything, so understanding the four or five things that you're going to be required to do, meeting with the other fire departments, looking at their equipment, coordinating tactics, great opportunity to take the plan that's on paper, execute it, and put it into action.
Yeah, and then you all know what everybody has as far as equipment, right?
Correct.
Somebody has a specialized thing over here, you don't have it,
yep.
You know when to call on them. Yeah. Going back to the basement, as far as, since there could be these unexploded devices, whatever you call them, is there an effort to try and identify what those might be in case of future fires? I mean, is there any way they can, you know, metal detectors or something to
so
go out?
And the base does a really good job. They know where a lot of these are. They know the impact area. They've kind of marked those off. They're doing fairly robust control burning, mm-hmm. I think we've seen in the last couple of years, which is good. So we always look at anything at the base, and even in the town of Sandwich, the Forestdale neighborhoods that abut the base, we're always on the lookout for unexploded ordnance. And you hear stories where people find them,
sure.
They're digging up a septic tank down Cape and they find it. It's on our radar, especially properties that abut the base, to, mm-hmm. to be on the lookout for that, and we tell our folks that. But the base has a very good handle on these areas, what's in there, and they do a great job of briefing our personnel when we go out there to assist,
yeah.
to say these are the things you need to be looking out for, these are the things we don't want you doing, these are the areas that we don't want you going to. Other than that,
right.
You know, you're good to go.
What about wildfires on Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard? Are there plans in place as far as mutual? Because, I mean, you got to take the ferry, right? That
yep.
takes a while.
So that is a unique program that the chiefs have been working on for many years, and it's been massaged and changed. But we meet on the Vineyard every year. In July, we meet The chiefs will go over. We simulate what an incident would be like. How are we going to get people? There are things called control chiefs. Chief Smith here in Falmouth is the control chief for the vineyard. So getting resources on the boat. As you can imagine, people have reservations in August to go to the vineyard, mm-hmm. and there's a significant incident, and there may be a need to hold those people back and put apparatus on those boats. Yeah. Nantucket's been actually utilized twice in the last 3 years, structural-wise. They had the hotel fire downtown.
Right. That was terrible.
So we immediately put 16 firefighters with equipment on the fast boat. So no apparatus. They needed the people. And I remember four of our personnel were part of that, and the looks that they got as they boarded the boat with their structural gear and their tanks, yeah. and people like, what's going on? As they pulled into Nantucket, they could see why they were going.
Wow. All right. Tor has a question about wildlife. Hi, Tor.
Hi. Good morning, and a beautiful day, and we're getting a little rain, and that's probably good for the cocoons and the chrysalids that are in the burn area, if they are still there.
Yeah. So what's your question?
I'm very curious to know, do we have anybody doing studies of the area prescribed burn occupied by silk moths like Cecropia, Polyphemus, and Promethea, and others, in these areas that belong to the moths over time, and they've evolved there, and then they might go up in flames if there's no survey underway to someone who knows about them, namely myself and others like Mark Mello. Mm-hmm. I can refer to the book I wrote, Butterflies Across Cape Cod, for reference.
Yeah. But you're wondering whether or not they look at that. Okay, thanks, Tor. Anybody know?
I was just going to say, on the prescribed burn, I thought Josh's analogy of a physician, right, prescribing that, they look at all of that. They look at the wildlife, endangered species that are in that particular area. That's all required to be analyzed and planned for accordingly. Okay. So, yes, the plant life in that is definitely analyzed as part of that.
Especially with the Department of Fisheries and Wildlife, that's part of their whole process of post-burn surveys going through there. And what I will say is, the animals, you know, really like it. We just burned yesterday at Crane in Falmouth.
And I was thinking of Crane.
We were just doing that. And, you know, as we're mopping up one section, we saw a hawk come down and be able to get, you know, dinner, but he wouldn't have been able to see that before on those high grasses. So.
Right. Well, and we should say that, like especially at Crane, a lot of the management there is to keep that habitat for some of those grassland species, right? So, exactly.
And they're utilizing even smoke hasn't been cleared. Yeah.
California and Hawaii have had wildfires start from electrical lines. How big of a risk is that for us?
It is somewhat of a risk. If you look at the power lines in this region, they're clear cut. A lot of it's clear cut. And then Eversource will notify a community that they want to do another clear cut to kind of keep the brush down. I thought Josh's point earlier about the trains and, you know, the fires that we have, and they're usually small, but we'll get notified of 6 or 8 small fires along 6A when the train is coming through. So I see the train as more of a...
Is it the sparks, and it just catches onto some like dry vegetation?
Yep. Yeah. And I think that, but again, on the power, Eversource is, we have a liaison that's assigned to our organization. They're very upfront. They're very good to work with in terms of the power lines. And you'll see that most power lines are very clear, and the risk of brush fires, they still can occur, but as long as they keep those clear cut, it's going to minimize the risk.
All right. So, and structural fires, perhaps a greater risk than wildfires in our region. It's good to be prepared for all, right?
Correct.
So let's talk about some of the things. We touched on some of it, on what people can do to reduce fire risk in their homes.
So smoke detectors, obviously, and carbon monoxide detectors. So Massachusetts does have a law that requires both smoke and carbon monoxide. Prior to the sale of your house, the fire department will come out and sign off on that certificate, making sure your smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors are actually working. Massachusetts also has, they like to see the smoke detectors replaced every 10 years.
Oh, okay.
So that's important. Another critical factor is when your house was built and what building code you fall under. Some are grandfathered, built prior to 1973, can have battery operated. Everything after that needs to be hardwired, interconnected, meaning when one goes off, they all go off. So I think no knowing when your house was built is important. And again, smoke detectors, one on every level, including carbon monoxide detectors on every level, will at least help.
And I think it's good advice because you can go, wait, when did I change that battery? When we change the daylight savings time, which is coming up.
It
right?
is. Another week. Next
so
week.
So that's when you want to maybe think about changing if you're using batteries.
Yep.
So tell me about this difference between batteries and hardwired, because it's like, you know, sometimes you're cooking and it goes off, and if it's a battery one, it's easier to turn off than if it's a
hardwired. Yeah, you pop the battery out and you don't have to worry about it. So the hardwired ones are obviously interconnected, and they give you better notification, because if you have three battery-operated detectors in your house, and it's a two-story house, and the basement detector is activated, you're on the second floor, you may not necessarily hear that. So again, having the interconnected detectors are good. And when the power goes out with the interconnected detectors, they have a battery backup. Mm-hmm. So even if you have interconnected detectors, daylight savings is approaching, you still want to swap out your batteries.
Oh, good to know.
Right, yeah. Just to make sure. So I think that's been a very successful campaign through the Department of Fire Services, reminding people. We try to do it through social media. Hey, twice a year you want to swap out your batteries or at least check them. Daylight savings time is a perfect time to do that.
Also, you know, we teach kids a lot about fire prevention in school, and they come home and they might go, what's our escape route, right? I mean, and that's, you know, what having a plan in, you know, we talk about firefighters planning, but
yep.
you need to have a plan even in your own home, right?
And we've actually expanded that. So the home escape, you know, is there a meeting spot that you would meet outside of the home? Don't go back into the home. But now we're looking at reunification pieces also. Right. So if there's a school evacuation, God forbid, an active shooter type incident, mm-hmm. how are you communicating? Parents and children. Smartphones are excellent, mm-hmm. But have a plan for that too. So not only home fire safety, but safety in general. When you're out and about, if you're separated, we call that reunification, and we do work with our students on that also.
Yeah. Anybody else have thoughts on what folks can do? You know, we didn't talk about if your home abuts some woods or some kind of brush, what are some things you need to keep in mind there?
You need to just look at, you know, the density of those fuels and how far that fire might spread on your property. And also, we talk about collaboration, working with your neighbors, working with some of those non-governmental agencies that own property next to you, and having those conversations and working together. But the first step is getting that home assessment done. And that's also part, we do the whole property. So we look at all the different zones away from and give those homeowners some suggestions on what they can do to kind of thin some of that stuff out.
So you do these assessments for anybody who wants them?
Yes, free of charge.
Free of charge.
And we also do it in conjunction with a lot of the local fire departments. So we just did a training on the Vineyard where we trained a bunch of firefighters to actually go out with us to do those home assessments.
How do people sign up for that?
They would just contact our office or send me an email, and then we can set up a time.
Awesome.
Chief, you might want to talk about sheds, too. You know, I know we all store our hazardous material in sheds.
Yeah. Excellent.
Good
excellent,
point.
Mike. Yep. Everything we don't want in the house goes into the shed.
Right.
So in terms of sheds, making sure that, again, we don't commingle certain chemicals. People have gas, propane. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that that stuff is kept separately. Take advantage of the county's programs for disposal of hazardous materials. It's usually in the springtime. Mm-hmm. It's in
Coming
Falmouth.
Up.
It's
yeah.
in Sandwich. Get rid of your paints. Get rid of all that. Take advantage of those you know, disposal days, because again, minimizing the risk of what is in your mm-hmm. in your house and in your sheds.
And we got a minute left, but grills. You told me something I didn't know.
So quickly on grills in Massachusetts, grills need to be on the first level of a home. So anything above the first floor, second, third, fourth floors, you're not supposed to have grills. Mm-hmm. We see it in the city. We don't have as many high rises here, but that is, you know, grills need to be on the first floor or the ground
level. Yeah, because they can be more dangerous than you think,
correct.
Right? Yeah,
yep.
Start fires. All right. John Burke's Fire Department Chief and Emergency Management Director for the Town of Sandwich and President of the Cape and Islands Fire Chiefs Association. Mike McGuire's Director of the Barnstable County Cooperative Extension Service, who oversees the County Wildlife Plan. Joshua Nigro, District 1 Forest Fire Warden for Barnstable, Dukes, and Nantucket counties, also part of the Department of Conservation and Recreation Forest Fire Control. So glad to know you guys have got this all planned out and lots of tips for us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Mindy.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.